That's the first thing. The second thing that's very helpful is having some kind of what's called a platform. And that I know is probably a word that everybody has talked about, everybody who comes on your show. And what it means is that there's some level of recognition of the person's name or their face on either a local level or hopefully on a national level. And Ron is an actor. He's been in Spencer for Hire, Law and Order, The Practice, Judging Amy, Sex and the City. And so he knows all these famous people, which is how he got to Stephen King, who eventually gave him an article about this, saying this is the best book you haven't read this year,
because
Ron couldn't get it published. But so having that platform is really helpful. And what else do you need? And then the rest of it's just luck and having things fall into place.
So it sounds like platform, and yeah, we do talk about platform quite a bit, but and it sounds more and more like platform is important in fiction, like as you just said, as well as nonfiction. It used to be that platform was, you know, really necessary in nonfiction, and you hardly ever heard anybody talk about it being necessary in fiction. But sounds like that's changing.
I don't know. I'm so bad at this kind of thing. I mean, I have a book now that I'm praying we're sort of in almost negotiating stages. I have an editor who's looking at the manuscript exclusively. It's an unbelievably cool story. It deals with the flood, Noah's Ark. And I can't tell you anymore because the book hasn't sold, otherwise I would. But the author has published a couple things in some literary journals, but his big claim to fame is he is an expert, and this is an important expertise, on second-story concrete parking structures. He's a carpenter, and he's written this lovely, beautiful, lyrical novel dealing with Noah's Ark, and who happened to be a carpenter, but we don't get into that. So this guy, this author's claim to fame is he has really nothing going for him that you'd think. He doesn't have any kind of prestigious MFA, and he hasn't published in The New Yorker and all that kind of stuff. But he's written a great book. So I still think the first thing is just to be able to write. But the second thing is there a way that we can sort of say that this author's career is really starting to take off? Is that the author's really out there doing something? And a lot of times it's publishing those articles or poetry even, or whatever it is. Sometimes it's something else. It's being an expert in second-story parking structures. So, I don't know. I get really frustrated. There's an online group I deal with. The person who founded it, it's called Backspace. Backspace, BKSP.org, something like that. And that's what everybody tells them on when they go on this website, that platform is crucial, and that's all people care about. And I just don't think it's true. I think people really think that you come to a novel because you love it, because something really works for you. And it's great if you have all those other pieces, like Ron does, or this Robert Hicks, who's a music producer and has like lots of famous friends. It's a really great piece to have, and that can kind of make the difference and push it over the top on some instances. But the bottom line is that book really has to work.
Yeah, and you've talked about beautiful language. You've talked about voice, and I suppose when a book has those things, and an agent, like you say, falls in love with it, then I mean, you just need one agent, and then one editor to really feel the same way for anything to happen.
I don't think so. I wish it were like that, but in order for that editor to fall in love with it, they have to convince their marketing department and their sales department and their publisher and their PR department and all the rest of these people. This is a big corporate decision. I mean, you're sitting in your closet writing your book, but what you're creating is nothing on some level different than a shoe or a chair or I don't know, some other commodity that has to be packaged in a certain way and shipped in a certain number of boxes and takes up this much space on the shelf and will sell for this much money and will use this much paper and ink. They're still commodities. And so it's not going to be this. I always think of, Milton sitting in that room in the dark with his daughters talking about how dust, the water, the liquid, like whether it was tears or water, bubbles up on the dust and how he can remember that. But I always think of Milton, and he didn't write this. There wasn't a committee writing this. No committee had to accept Paradise Lost. But on some level, a committee now determines, you know, the state of publishing these days and the state of a lot of things. So we have to play ball. So if you have a book that one person likes and then a second person likes, that's a good start. But then we have to have a room full of people that are going to like it.
Mm-hmm. So then at that point, these other things come into play, like platform and these other things. I'm sure marketing, you know, they're looking at, you know, are we going to be able to sell this, and how many are we going to be able to sell, and you know, the pragmatic aspects of book publishing.
Yeah, and I mean, I know the Robert Hicks is an example. Can I give that story real briefly?
Sure.
Or too long?
Well, you know, let's take a quick break and come back, and then we have another 25 minutes.
Okay.
So all of you out there, stay with us. I'll be right back with Jeff Kleinman. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Someone's built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And let me just say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. And we've been here since 5 with Jeff Kleinman, a literary agent and intellectual property attorney with Graybill and English in New York. And here he is again. Hello there.
Hi there. One correction. We have offices in Washington and New York.
Okay.
So two places.
There you go.
There you are.
Tell me about Randall Hicks.
Robert Hicks.
Robert Hicks. See?
You will so know that name.
Really something. Okay, Robert Hicks.
Well, let me kind of break this. I'll explain. I'll give you an analysis as I go, because maybe this will help the situation. The first thing is, it's based on a true story, which is always cool and can be do nice things. One of the big things about promotion is, how do you promote a novel? You know, you're sitting across from Katie Couric, and what is she going to say? Oh, I think your characters are so nice. You know, I mean, what do you say to somebody? If you have something based in truth, based on some historical fact or some information, Katie can start talking about that. She can say, oh, you know, so tell me about whatever. So in this case, it's based on some real events, which I'll kind of tell you. And the real events have never been known, or never really been talked about, which is another great thing, if you can find that untold story. That's another good kind of piece to have. So my story I'm going to tell you is, about the Battle of Franklin, which took place in 1864, November 1864. It was one of apparently like the five bloodiest battles, or the five bloodiest hours of the Civil War. I guess like 9,600 people, there's 9,600 casualties, most of them on the Confederate side. And so you have all this immediate, we're talking, this is the most, you know, you have that sort of feeling of this is, it's not just some little battle that nobody heard of, it's the most something. And publishers like that, as does the public. So during this battle, right before the battle, a guy named Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and a former slave trader and a Confederate general, came to this house on the outskirts of what would be the battle. The house was called Carnton, and the house still stands, which is the other kind of neat piece of this whole thing. Carnton is now fully restored in this unbelievably beautiful manor home. Carnton.org, C-A-R-N-T-O-N. Anyway, he comes to this manor house, which is owned by a woman named Carrie McGavick. And according to the author, she had five children. Three of them had died. So, you know, this is what I'm telling you. Remember what I said? I don't deal with children in peril.
Uh-huh.
Luckily, none of the children die on stage. They're dead before the book starts. And they're only alluded to. Otherwise, I probably couldn't deal with it. But anyway, we have these... the death of the children has pretty much sent her over the edge. She spends all her time in their cemetery talking to them. She's painted them. She's had them painted in an oval frame that she hangs at the foot of her bed, and she calls them her angels. And the rooms are left like little museums. And the house is basically run by her slave, a woman named Mariah. So Nathan Bedford Forrest comes to Carnton, which incidentally means City of the Dead, and commandeers the house for a Confederate hospital. And they start bringing in the wounded, because, again, this is one of the bloodiest battles of the war. And it's a scene like out of Gone with the Wind, you know, the Battle of Richmond, where there's just dead everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of thing, where they fill up the house and the grounds and the barn, and the cut-off arms and legs go higher than the second-story window. Actually, the one dead daughter's room is used as a surgery, and you can still see the blood on the floor. Mm-hmm. It's that... And the surgeon stood there for so long, it just packed it in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, lots and lots of people died during this battle. But something happened to Carrie that night. And this is the other thing that you always want to have. You want to have some kind of transformation of a character. You want to see them growing. And in this case, the transformation was dramatic, immediate, and very, very sudden. And there are these eyewitness accounts of the widow of Mrs. McGavick, how she's wading in blood and tearing apart the house. To save these people. And according to the author, the way he thinks in Carrie's mind happened is, you know, suddenly she has this chance to save the kids she couldn't save in her own life. And she has the opportunity to not be have a house of death, but have a house of healing. So she literally saves all these guys. So after the war is over, you know, months go by, and Carrie is sort of a force in the town at this point, Carrie McGavick. And for whatever reason, a neighboring landowner decides he's going to dig up about 1,500 graves and plant crops there, because this is, again, at this point the war is over, everybody's desperately poor, he needs the land to, you know, to graze cotton. So with the help from the town, Carrie organizes a group of people, and they dig up 1,500 bodies, transplant them back to her personal cemetery. She reburies them alongside her children and spends the next 40 years of her life writing to the families of these dead children, of these dead soldiers, saying, your son is buried here. No, he'll always have a place here, but if you want to come and get him, this is where you need to come. And when she died, her death made the newspapers from Chicago to San Francisco to New York. I think it's an unbelievably cool story. And this is all true, what I've just told you.
Hmm. How much did you see of that or hear of it before you took it on? I mean, it's like, at what point did you go, I need to rep this?
All I had was a story and a guy who'd been working on a book for about 5 years, and it wasn't even finished. It needed some more work, and he ran out of money to do it. So... but that kind of story, that kind of true story, and that kind of the kind of transformation, that transformative event, and that whole richness that you can imagine with all of these characters and this kind of world. I mean, how do you not take something like that on?
Mm-hmm.
I actually sold that thing on 100 pages. He couldn't
really?
Make it to finish it. Yeah,
that's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very unusual.
With
and,
fiction.
It's also one of the most beautifully written books on the planet. I mean, I think it's just it's really, really strong. I mean, the characters, the editor and I have arguments. You know, I remember we'd be talking about the manuscript, and she said, you know, I was up crying in chapter 5. And I'd be like, you cried in chapter 5? You didn't. I didn't cry in chapter 5. I cried in chapter 2. You cried in chapter 2? And we have these discussions about, you know, like where we burst into tears. Or, you know, Carrie wouldn't say that. Of course she'd say this. You know, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't like we were talking about these characters. We were talking about these people that we knew.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, like,
sure.
Literally, I can tell you what Carrie would eat for breakfast today. Even though, you know, she's not around. But
yeah.
You feel so much like you know her. And I think that's such a gift.
Well, it also, it seems to me, too, because, you know, there's so many agents. And there are few agents, though, that seem to have the sort of energy that you seem to have here. And I wonder... I mean, I can only imagine that that's a good thing for clients, you know, to have an agent that's just so energized about their work that they are willing to get out there and do what it takes.
I know there are a bunch of people out there. I hear about a lot of agents, and they're sort of maybe been around for a while and have done this and are jaded or tired or, you know, more interested in their house in the Hamptons or whatever. But I don't know. All the people I always meet are just great. All the other agents, they're like enthusiastic and fun and, you know, wanting to make this work and just doing this because they love it. So I don't think I'm at all exceptional. I wish I were. But,
well, I don't know. Maybe you have better sales ability or something. I don't know what it is. You just, I don't know.
Well, thank you.
Anyway. But, you know, that brings me to my next question, which is, how often will you send something out before you go, it's just not happening? Or do you just keep on until it does happen?
It really depends on the project. I've had one novel that I've sent to 40 places, and I've asked her to revise it because I want to send it again.
Mm-hmm.
I won't let this thing go, and I've worked on this thing for like probably 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But she's had a baby, and she has other things going on, and she hasn't gotten back to me. And further. I have a couple other things where you send it to 5 or 10 places, and you just know it's not going to work, and you shouldn't waste the author's time or money or anything else. So it really depends. I mean, especially with fiction, it's just so tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem to need a lot more going on to sell.
Yeah, you just want something else. You know, the thing that both the McLarty and the Robert Hicks thing have going for them is they have this whole world outside the book that really works. I mean, Robert's inviting people to visit Carnton, which is a fully restored. He's actually the instrument behind the restoration. He sort of founded. He's on the board. He's the guy who's really the reason for the restoration, but it's museum-quality restoration, this gorgeous building. The Franklin Battlefield, he's just done this whole reclamation project to keep it from becoming strip malls. And, you know, people can go there and walk around and sort of follow the character's footsteps. And McLarty, you know, you have this actor who can go and talk about all these other things. What's it like to be a blue-collar actor? What's it like to try for 15 years to get your book published and no one wants to read it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's this other story, there's a meta story, and having something like that can be very helpful.
Well, but, and I have heard that it's from publicists who approach me to have their novelists come on the show, and they've said that there are few venues for novelists because many talk show hosts feel that novelists can only talk about the novel, and they don't have anything else to talk about,
yeah.
Which is really kind of odd. Actually,
well, I mean, the thing I guess you have to try doing is figuring out. Okay, I mean, this is a good example is Ron McLarty. You know,
yeah.
When we were trying to sell that. I didn't know, you know, people were going to really come to it in a big way, or publishers would be that enthusiastic. The thing had been shopped around New York already. So, you know, when I knew when I started sending the thing out, I mean, I was absolutely in love with this book. but it very easily could have gone to everyone on the planet, and they said, oh, yeah, we remember seeing that 5 years ago. Yeah, we don't want it. So, you know, that can easily happen. So I made him sit down and figure out if he goes on some kind of talk show circuit, what he could talk about. And the things I just mentioned are things we came up with, being a blue-collar actor. He's a recorded books narrator. I mean, he narrates for not just recorded books, but for audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about reading aloud, talking about creating characters, dealing with acting, talking about being a screenwriter, whatever it is that... what other things can you talk about that we can somehow bring the book into so people want to buy the book, but they would want to come to get the information that you can provide?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So Kathy Reichs is a perfect example with all her great stuff that's happening. And, you know, she can talk about forensic anthropology, which is a great thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am still here with Jeff Kleinman, and we have about 15 more minutes. You talked about books are still sold by word of mouth. You said that at the beginning of the program. And so I wonder if you could talk a little more about that. I'm curious. There always seems to be such pressure to have your book reviewed by the major magazines, or hope that it's reviewed by Publishers Weekly and, New York Times, and, you know, all of these wonderful places that very few people actually get reviewed in.
And very few people actually read.
Yeah, okay. But you know, again, you said books are still sold by word of mouth. Could you talk a little more about that?
Well, I guess to me, all books are either they're sold by one of two ways. They're either media driven or review driven. So a media driven book is the Goldie Hawn thing, or what's the actress, Brooke Shields.
Mm-hmm.
Those are both sort of memoirs, but those are good examples of sort of celebrities, Jane Fonda on 60 Minutes, that are just going to be sold. Not because there's a review, but because the media is coming to it. I work on a book called Inside the Wire, which is like the first story of Guantanamo Bay. And the author was on every major show on the planet. And I don't think the book was reviewed anywhere. Actually, it was. It started getting a lot of reviews, but sort of a little bit after the fact. So that was a book that had to sell via the media. Review-driven books are books that hopefully the more thoughtful people that read nowadays are going to read and get excited about writing to pick up the book, you're going to pick up that book. But in either case, there's a million other people out there that didn't see Goldie Hawn on TV and didn't read the review in, you know, San Francisco Chronicle, that are going to, for whatever reason, pick up that book or find that book and then talk about it or hear about it because somebody else has said, I just read Goldie Hawn's book. You've got to pick it up. It's really cool. So, I mean, that's, to me, I don't know about you, but when somebody says, oh, you got to read this book, you kind of pay attention.
Sure.
So rather than Katie Kirk saying, oh, you got to read this book, or a better example, word of mouth, is Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
You got to read this book? Okay.
Right.
Cha-ching.
Right.
So, and there's nothing wrong with that, but because we trust Oprah, we trust her sensibilities, we kind of watch her every day at 4 o'clock or whatever, okay, I'll go read this book.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but to me, it's still all, on some level, it's still word of mouth.
Well, what do you think about all of the online venues these days? You know, there's so many blogs and so many online magazines that, you know, promote books.
Yeah, and those can be really useful. I know a lot of people are really trying to get into that and really trying to make those be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's another great area. I tend to deal a little bit less with that because it's usually sort of more of a niche sometimes, or I just don't really have time to monkey around with a lot of that. But I know it can be a really valid way of doing things.
Sure. And it seems to young adult fiction has really kind of amped up in recent months, maybe the last year. It seems like I see so many deals happening for young adult fiction. Is there some sort of change going on, or has it just always been that way and I just haven't noticed?
No, I think YA is definitely more popular. It's not an area I deal with, but you sort of see these sort of mega deals that are going down. Aragon, you know, just the latest example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all of these kinds of things, and clearly there's a YA market that is coming to books in a bigger way than we expected, or maybe that people thought in the past.
Yeah.
Which is great, you know, the fact that people are reading.
What do you think about nonfiction writers crossing over to fiction? Is that a difficult transition, or does it depend kind of what sort of nonfiction author they were? What do you think about that?
I think any kind of transition from romance to Western to psychology and self-help to, I don't know, erotica or whatever it is. The bottom line is if the first books are selling in a big way and you have a following, then, you know, I think publishers are going to give you a lot of leeway. Oh, sure, you want to do a novel? Okay, you want to do a memoir? Sure. You know, what, no problem.
Right.
If the books don't sell all that well, then it can be sort of a new chance for the writer to sort of a new lease on life.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have to sort of deal with this nonfiction issue, how it hasn't sold, or these other fiction things that haven't sold. So it can be sort of a curse and a blessing. But, you know, I guess I'm still so much of an idealist. I keep thinking, you know, if your heart is in writing this novel, even if you published like 40 nonfiction books, then you just got to do it.
Right.
You know? To me, it's got to be because you love this, what you're doing, and that has to come out on every page. And if you're writing this novel because you don't really, you know, because you need something to do, because you know, you have to babysit the kid or something, then maybe take up knitting.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, what comes in, what do you see too much of? Is there, like, too much of anything right now, or is that something that writers shouldn't think about in any way?
I mean, that's why, frankly, I listed serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of serial killers. There's a lot of how September 11th affected me,
mm-hmm.
and how a bunch of Arabs are going to take over the world on some by doing X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a lot of that kind of stuff. And then you see a lot, and I know they're having problems sort of selling these things, the sort of techno thrillers. So using technology, biotechnology, or whatever it is, I mean, you know, Michael Crichton and a bunch of other people have been very successful, but I think those are harder sales too. So I don't know. I mean, I think the idea of trying to use a current event to talk about a project or current cutting edge science or something, it can really work in the sense that like the Robert Hicks novel really works because there's this whole sort of reality that you can play into it. But there's also a feeling, I think, that people come up with an idea for a book. I want to do a book about, I have this great idea for cloning, you know, this great clone book. And they write that clone book as opposed to writing a book that really comes from their heart because they have this character in them that they really want to explore, or they have something that they really want to think about. And instead they're writing something that they think can sell. So that's the stuff I guess I would steer clear of.
Mm-hmm. A few more minutes left. Gimmicks. Do gimmicks work? Do queries in pizza boxes work?
Chocolate always works.
Really?
It has caramel. Caramel chocolate, yes. I'll give you the address at the end. I don't know. To me, I always think that this business, it's such a weird thing. But at some level, it's the same thing as getting a job interview and writing a letter. Dear sir, I read about you on on the bathroom wall, and I want to send you a book.
Mm-hmm.
Or dear sir, I read your ad in the newspaper, and I know you're looking for a new receptionist.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is. But somehow that letter in both cases has to be professional and clear and sharp and also kind of convey the writer's passion for whatever it is. You know, I can be an amazing receptionist. I answer phones like no one's business. You know, whatever it is. Again, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but and I don't mean to say that you should say I'm the best writer in the world, because I don't think that's the answer. But
mm-hmm.
somehow you should communicate the fact that, you know, since the time I was born, I've been answering phones. And there's nothing I like better than coordinating meetings or whatever it is. And, you know, you tend to look at those letters, wow, this guy's really passionate about this kind of thing. And you either comes across as a nutcase or she comes across as, you know, some really capable, interesting person that you think can do the job.
Sure.
So that's what I look for.
So do you get style through queries, or is that just not important? Is it really just whether you feel you can connect with the person writing the query letter?
I'm sorry? Can you repeat? What's the first thing?
Well, style. I'm wondering...
Oh, yeah. No, I do.
You do?
I think everybody does. I think if you read a sort of a clumsy query letter or that goes on for pages and pages, I would kind of probably steer clear of it because I think, gosh, if he can't be concise and tell me why he wants this job... I'm not sure I want to get involved in it. I mean, what I have done is actually created two errors tonight, talking about the McLarty book or talking about the Hicks book, because neither of them are really great. I can, if I need to, sum them up in a single sentence. But books need to be summed up really quickly for the sales and marketing people to get it. So there's a feeling of real conciseness that you need to have. But in any case, I mean, I don't think it's a question of gimmick or having your picture in there or... having balloons get delivered with the manuscript or whatever, it's all going to be in the actual package itself, the actual writing, the actual what it is. And if it's not there, it's just not there. I mean, I think everybody opens the mail. I mean, you know, you're sitting there doing other things and you're kind of opening it because you have to, but there's also a feeling you're opening all these little gifts. You know, you get all this mail. Geez, all these people are writing to me. So cool. So there is a feeling of, kind of, maybe this is going to be it. Maybe this is going to be the cool book that we've been waiting for. And I think everybody does that still.
Sure. Well, I wanted to ask, how do you find most of your clients? I mean, is it a mix between, you know, a few that do come out of the slush pile, referrals, conferences? Is it just a mix or, you know?
Almost never through conferences, alas. Although I just sold a book to Atria yesterday, from a woman I met at a conference. But most of them are through ideas I have myself. I'd say about 40 to 50% of them. And then maybe another 20% are referrals, and maybe 20, 30% are, you know, either slush piles or conferences or something.
Interesting. Do you read journals and look for, writers, short story writers or essay writers and that you like and then, you know, email them or call them and say, do you have anything?
Yeah, I did. I used to do that a lot. I've been sort of overwhelmed the past like year and I haven't had a chance to do that. But that's a great way of doing things. And, you know, I really recommend, you know, I know a ton of friends of mine. That's how they pick up a lot of their clients. They read, you know, whatever it is, Glimmer Train or something, and call up the author within minutes. And I know it's like sometimes several agents were calling the same person because you read something and it really works and you're excited. I mean, it's hard as anything to publish something, but it's also, everybody's also looking for some great new thing.
Sure.
It's sort of an eternally, it's a completely optimistic and pessimistic business.
We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Yeah, just don't think about the whole agent stuff. just turn this radio off right now.
Forget about agents.
No, because, I mean, when Ron started having a success, it wasn't because he was writing to sell a book. It was because he was writing about something he was passionate about.
Yeah.
He was writing to explain the world to himself. And it just so happens he has the writing tools to do that. So that's thing one. And the second thing is find somebody to help work with you. Not a book doctor or a freelance editor, but a friend or colleague or somebody you can exchange manuscripts with and sort of understand somebody else's perspective. And the third thing, can I have time for a third thing?
Sure. You have time for a fourth thing even.
Oh, okay. So I'll stop me when I'm done. But the big thing that people really don't do is take the time to really develop characters. And a woman named, so I'm crediting her. Her name is Diane Chamberlain. She's done a bunch of books. And she did talk a little writer's group I belong to called How to Create Characters So Real You'll Be Tempted to Claim Them as Dependents on Your Tax Returns. And her suggestion, which I think is so brilliant, is interview the character. So I'm like, oh, yes, I've heard this before. You know, what's your mother's name? What's your favorite color? Ask them the weirdest questions you can think of. What kind of do you like your marshmallows lightly toasted or burned? Do you vacuum in patterns or in straight lines? Do you sit in a window seat or an aisle seat on the airplane? And then ask them why. And then just keep asking them, what do you mean do I vacuum in patterns? Of course I vacuum in patterns. It has to look nice because you can see it from above. Well, or no, of course, I don't have time to vacuum pants. Why don't you have time? Because I have other things going on. Why do you have other things going on? You know, I don't have time to just sit around all the time. And keep asking this character questions until the voice stops being the author and starts being the characters. That's the thing that I found almost never people do, is they don't create real characters that really feel like they can walk around and breathe.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Well, good.
Yeah, that's good. Do
I have time for more?
You have time for another.
Okay, so here's my last suggestion. I just filled the suggestion. This one I don't think I can credit to anybody. I think this is mine, but it could be somebody's. And if it is, I apologize if I screwed it up. Make your friend read the manuscript, hard copy, because agents and editors generally read things from paper, with a pen in one hand. And as they're reading, have their eye go down the right or left side of the page, have the pen trace down where they are. So literally there's a line going down the right side of the margin.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that you look away, your reader looks away or starts thinking about dinner or has to reread something because they didn't understand it, any time they stop, for whatever reason, have them draw a line.
Mm.
And if they draw more than, I would say, two or three lines in the first three or four pages, rewrite the whole book.
Interesting.
And the reason I'm thinking that is because everybody says, the first pages are the most important. And I think most people know that and spend a lot of time on those first pages. So if those first pages have those kind of page stoppers in them, then my feeling is that probably the rest of the book does too.
Yeah.
And again, that thought is that you have to miss your subway stop. So mm-hmm. if I looked up from the page three times, I won't miss my subway stop.
Yeah.
So.
That's a good one.
See, and you thought I was going to have useless things to say.
No, I never thought that. I appreciate you coming on. It's great.
Well, thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, you're fun. And thanks.
Well, thank you.
So
and
much.
Are we set?
We're set.
All right. Well, thanks again, and we'll talk to you hopefully soon.
We will.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye. That was Jeff Kleinman. He is a literary agent and intellectual property attorney with Graybill & English, with offices in New York and Washington, D.C. And he's a lot of fun. He's on a tape, an ASJA tape, that you can find by going to asja.org and go to the tapes or CDs for the 2005 conference. And he did a workshop that was so interesting on positioning books and, with mock editors and mock publicists. It was really quite fun. Anyway, great guy. We're at the end of our time. If you want to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. And you can read about my book, Pen on Fire, which is all over that site. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Jessamine West, who said, "The writer must be willing, above everything else, to take chances, to risk making a fool of himself, or even to risk revealing the fact that he is a fool." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I am Barbara DeMarco Barrett still, and until next time, I wish you well.